This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The hackable election. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Experts say it's impossible to hack the 2016 presidential election, but enough incidents could happen at the local level to undermine faith in the system. We'll explain.
College campuses are seeing an enormous spike in students seeking mental health services. Can schools accommodate them?
Why your gym is now collecting data about what you do there.
And where does this dominant season by the Chicago Cubs rank in the history of baseball, and what kind of World Series predictor is it?
Teams that win 100 plus games don't win the World Series all that often compared to what we might, you know, kind of intuitively think. When it's such an eye-catching number and such an impressive number, you would think that they would win the World Series more often.
Neil Payne at 538.com on the year of the Cubs. He's here later in the hour. Well, the impact of Russian hacking on the upcoming presidential election was a topic in last Sunday's debate, you might recall, raising the question, is the U.S. election hackable? Experts say at the national level, no, it is not. But USA Today reporter Elizabeth Weiss says there could be individual incidents that undermine faith in the system. Elizabeth, what are we looking at?
There's two issues. I mean, the broader issue is, could the U.S. presidential election be hacked enough that we would not know who the electorate had actually voted for president. And according to everyone, including the head of the FBI, major election officials, they all say it's impossible. At the micro level, though, an individual, maybe a ballot machine, an individual ballot machine, or perhaps just one voting place, it is possible, and it's more possible in some areas than others, that there might be a hack, and that's of concern to voting officials for a couple of different reasons.
All right, so explain.
So for the nation as a whole, the reason that we are safe is actually because our technology is pretty ancient. There are countries in the world, Estonia is a good example, where they have very cutting-edge technology, and there's a couple of countries that actually vote electronically as a nation. Now, the problem with that is there's one centralized point, and if you get in, you actually could go in and change all the votes, or at least change enough to affect the outcome. In the United States, we have a wildly decentralized system. Each state, each county, often each municipality functions differently. They buy their own voting machines, they set up their own systems, and so you'd have to hack thousands of different entities to affect the overall national election. And even if it were a state actor, and the NSA and others have named Russia as a country that appears to be attempting to affect the election outcome, mostly by leaking or by hacking information, it's probably beyond the Russians or anybody to hack that many localities and actually have an effect.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Weiss, computer security writer at USA Today. Her story is called, Could the U.S. Election Be Hacked? All right, so explain what could happen, say, on the local level.
Well, and that's where it gets a little iffier. When I talk to people at Verified Voting or at even at the Office of Homeland Security, which is looking at election, the integrity of the U.S. electoral system, they say there are places, there are states that do not have as secure voting mechanisms as they might. Actually, only California and Colorado have state laws that mandate that there be a paper audit trail for every vote. And it's interesting because we think of electronics and computers as being very cutting edge, but actually when you're talking about voting, paper is the gold standard.
Wow.
Because it's really hard to change paper after somebody's made their vote. And so states or municipalities that use paper ballots, Some of them use the paper ballot that you run through a machine that reads it. There are places that still have paper ballots. That's considered the safest of all. And you also want a paper audit trail so that should there be any questions later on, you're not just relying on some software in a machine that maybe it had malware infected in it and therefore wasn't properly counting. You want to be able to go back, have paper, and count. Only California and Colorado mandate that. So there's a fair number of states where there are some all electronic voting machines left, and those are considered to be more at risk. Nobody's saying that anybody's hacking into them right now, but it's a concern. I mean, the good news is there's not that many of them. About 70% to 80% of all Americans who will vote in the presidential election will vote in an area where there is a paper backup trail. So their vote's pretty secure.
All right. So what's been the advice, say, from the FBI to these state and local elections officials?
So the Department of Homeland Security actually a couple of months back put out a kind of an open call to every electoral district in the nation that they would be happy to send in agents to do an electronic audit of their system, look at it top to bottom, and make sure that it was as safe as it possibly could be. They've done about 30 states so far. That was actually numbers that they gave me yesterday. And they put out a release yesterday to the remaining states and the remaining localities saying, listen, we got 27 days until the election now. If you want us to do this, call us now, because it takes a week or so for them to get the permission to go in. They've got to go in, get their people to run through it, and then once they get the results, figure out what they need to do to make that more secure.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Weiss at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour on this weekend, about midway through October now, right? There's been a dramatic increase in the number of college students seeking help for mental health issues. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson paid a visit to Ohio State University to get a feel for what's going on and what schools are doing about this. Andrea, what have you found?
Colleges around the country in the last several years have been seeing dramatically increased demand for college counseling services, for therapy, and it's reflecting a really big increase in the number of students who are saying that they're having mental health issues. The rates of anxiety and depression among college students have really been growing quite dramatically in the last few years, and so college counseling centers are really seeing this big uptick. It's unclear why this is happening. Therapists point to everything to the economy, the rising cost of tuition, impact of social media, and even, what people call the helicopter parenting style that doesn't allow adolescents to experience failure. But also, I mean, the truth is also that college counseling centers have brought some of this on themselves, this increased demand in the last several years, that they've been really aggressively doing outreach with students, trying to really increase their visibility on campus, making themselves warm and accessible, and really sort of driving home the message that there shouldn't be any stigma associated with reaching out if you have mental health issues.
Well, I remember when
part of it they say is a good thing, reaching more students that may have been not willing to ask for help in the past.
I have a friend who teaches at Rutgers University tell me just yesterday, he said, these kids are so stressed out come midterm time.
Yeah.
And I said, why? Mm-hmm. He said, college is expensive, so they have to work.
Right.
Because they work, they have minimal time for studies, so they're jamming everything in. He said, you can't even talk to them come midterm time.
Yeah. So I was actually at Ohio State last week and visiting, and I could really feel the sort of palpable sense of stress and sort of anxiety coming from students as they were sort of getting into the exam time. Now, what some college counseling centers are doing, what they're finding is that they have to be able to harness their resources and make sure that they're to reach everybody. They need to sort of discern which students really need mental health counseling, therapy, actual treatment for a mental illness, versus, what students might be okay with a workshop, say, on anxiety.
Yeah.
So, at Ohio State, they've really increased the number of these sort of drop-in workshops. I actually sat in on a beating anxiety workshop where one of the psychologists, gave some tips to students, basically, told them, first of all, explain what anxiety was, and also, really went through some of the things that students can do to sort of combat anxiety from going out of control, things like not eating Chipotle 3 times a day and like getting some exercise to how to sort of reframe negative thoughts.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson. Her story is called Students Flood College Mental Health Centers. What makes it different today? You and I worked. We had to study a lot to get through. Why is it different now?
I mean, like I said, people point to all sorts of different things, whether it's, social media and sort of the, comparing ourselves to everybody else and the sort of negative effects of that to, college was a lot cheaper when you and I went to school.
Yeah, true.
And it's kids are taking out a lot more loans, so there's a lot more sort of economic pressure. Also, the economy's different. Students really talk about, they're, even from the get-go, they're incredibly focused on, getting those top grades, getting the internships that are going to lead to a good job. There's a real palpable sense that a bachelor's degree is not necessarily the ticket to a decent job. So those pressures are definitely, I think, more prominent than they were when we were in school. Also, there is less stigma around mental health issues and seeking help for those. So students are also just more comfortable asking for help.
Thanks, Andrea. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson. 21 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Amazon is trying to change your grocery store experience. They're opening their own brick-and-mortar shops, according to the Wall Street Journal, where you could pick up your perishables like milk, meat, vegetables, toss them in your car, and also order your non-perishables, like peanut butter, canned soup, while in the store and then have them delivered on the same day. Here's tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group, the tech advisory firm. Rob set this up.
Well, they're going to open stores. Small regional stores in a neighborhood near you, and the idea is you'll go in and you'll buy groceries, perishables. But you also see displays of other Amazon products, which you'll be able to order and have delivered to your house the same day. This is something they've been talking about for a long time. If you realize a lot of Amazon sales are people going into places like Best Buy, they see something they like, and then they check the price on Amazon and order it from Best Buy, which has been a big problem for Best Buy. Mm. But there's always a chance, of course, if they're in Best Buy, they'll just grab the thing and buy it then. With this particular model, you're in the Amazon store, you're going to order it from Amazon because that's where you are. And as I say, the nice thing is if it's not carried in the store, it'll be waiting for you by the end of the day on your front porch.
Right.
So it's a way for them to move more product that they're not moving now. They've had grocery capability for a while in some areas, but they don't move a lot of groceries because people are used to going into stores and buying groceries. But then leveraging the might of Amazon behind it, so even though you're going into a small grocery store, you basically are in a Walmart in terms of product coverage, and for anything that you buy, you get that option of having, or you get that advantage of having it delivered for you, so you don't have to haul it home deal with all the transport. So it's an interesting. We'll see how it plays out. It's really dealing with how people have been buying products from them for a while, but executing a plan of control so that you are surrounded by Amazon and you're not likely to buy that product from the vendor who you're actually visiting.
Who's threatened by this, Rob?
Pretty much. I mean, if you're Best Buy, this is not good news. If you're Walmart, this isn't good news because the stores will cost a lot less than Walmart. That they'll have a similar kind of diversity in terms of everything from, televisions and washing machines and appliances that can be delivered for you all the way through to groceries. So probably a little light on clothing because the clothing is difficult to do this way.
Yeah.
But almost everything else, and for a fraction of the cost of a Walmart store and likely much more conveniently placed, because you could put one of these small stores in a strip mall, you could put it downtown, you could put it you don't have the same restrictions that you have with, you know, a warehouse store like Walmart. So the end result is, yeah, if you're in this business of having a big retail presence, this model is incredibly disruptive if it works. It's very much like what Tesla's doing to the car companies by making dealerships obsolete. It's potentially very disruptive, and it appeals to what appears to be the way people want to buy. It's kind of like the web, but in a store. So you get everything very quickly. You order it there. They're going to make it very convenient for you to pretty much hit a button and get the product. And undoubtedly they'll begin registering you as you come through the door, especially if you're a Prime member. So they'll certainly offer up things that you might be interested in on monitors sitting around the store. So it's a very high tech way to revolutionize retail sales.
Well, we're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. We're talking about Amazon's venture into the grocery business. So it could be like, for example, I'll take a bag of apples, a gallon of milk, and two bags of dog food, and if you would, have that 60-inch TV delivered to my house by 4 this afternoon.
That kind of thing, though, that bigger items might take more than, it depends on where they're warehouse, because they do have the regional warehouses. So if you're near a regional warehouse, that's very possible. Though for the big TV, you might actually want them to set it up for you. I just tried to do a 70-inch by myself, and it wasn't pretty. But you could certainly have apples, cereal, and then that end table that you like delivered to your house, or even a dishwasher or washing machine. So it is going to be a brave new world.
Interesting new concept, right? Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group, the tech advisory firm. By the way, the first store, brick and mortar wise, for Amazon is planned for the company's home city of Seattle. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
Well, who'd ever think that a top-level professional athlete would be diagnosed with diabetes? It happened to NBA Hall of Famer Dominique Wilkins, the most celebrated player to ever put on an Atlanta Hawks uniform. And he's the Hawks vice president of basketball. He made a name for himself as an exceptional dunker, which earned him the nickname the Human Highlight Film, or the Human Highlight Reel. Dominique, how did the Human Highlight Film ever get diagnosed with diabetes?
Well, I stopped being the highlight. Now I'm just human. I think it runs in my family. My father and grandfather both died from diabetes. Mm. And like you say, a year after I retired, I found I was a diabetic. So that's what really helped push me into really using diabetes as a calling to help other people. And one of the things I'm most proud of in really helping people manage with their diabetes is being the diabetes ambassador for the state of Georgia through the Georgia legislature. So that's a big part of my life now, really helping people help themselves.
Very good. So when you were diagnosed at 40, did that mean you had probably had it for some time? Or like what made you raise questions or go to the doctor, I guess? I mean, you were an NBA superstar.
Usually when you find that you're a diabetic, diabetes has been in your system for more than 10 years.
Oh, okay.
But when you're in great shape and you work out all the time, diabetes is very hard to detect because you're constantly burning those calories off. So I could have played 2 or 3 more years at the end of my career if I wanted to, because people ask me all the time, could I play longer if I found I was a diabetic? And the answer to that is no, because I was in great shape.
What do you recall from those playing days the most? Like the thing I guess that came to my mind, you were such a obviously a great dunker. Did anybody say at a road game tell you to your face before the game, you're not dunking in this building tonight? And then you sort of made a mission to do it.
This is the funny thing is dunking was a tool for intimidation that I used.
Yeah,
it really wasn't who I was, but the dunks that I had was so dramatic, everybody think I, every point I ever scored was a dunk. Right. But it's very hard to score over 26,000 points on dunks.
Right, right.
I was a creative scorer. I could play inside, outside, on the post, off the dribble. I shot more than 10 to 12 free throws a night.
Yeah, yeah.
I had games where I scored 40 and I had one or two dunks in that game. So I used it for a tool for intimidations. And if I got in a groove, it was nothing a player can do individually. He's going to need help that night. Right. So I was going to get to the basket one way or the other.
Right. I remember I saw you play at the United Center in Chicago against Jordan, I want to say late 80s. I think my lungs are still sore from that night, screaming like, "Give it to Dominique!" And then the Bulls would get out of it like, "Give it to Jordan!" Like, I had one shot to see you guys play together. I just wanted highlights that whole game. Do you remember epic battles with him or not necessarily?
Oh yeah. Remember all of them. Jordan was a pleasure to play against because he brought out the best in me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know I brought out the best in him. And we had some epic, epic battles in the United Center, in the Omni at that time. We had some battles. And I tell you what, I wouldn't change a thing. I remember him being carried out on a stretcher in the playoffs. And I just knew we were going to win the series then. You know, Michael's being carried off on a stretcher.
Right.
It's ready to be on for the Hawks.
Right.
Came back at halftime and scored 30, and they won.
Right.
So I think he set me up for that one.
Right.
But, you know, they end up winning the series.
Atlanta Hawks great and NBA Hall of Famer Dominique Wilkins. He's involved with a project, by the way, from Novo Nordisk. The website is called DiabetesDreamTeam.com. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, politicians use it, stores use it. The latest to start collecting and analyzing data, your gym. As competition grows, more clubs are trying to understand what's happening on a fitness floor. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
How hard you work out at the gym just might depend on where the equipment is set up. That's only one thing the gyms have discovered through their analysis of data. Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal is here to tell us what gyms need to do to get and keep your business. Rachel, why are gyms collecting so much data?
Well, it's kind of amazing, Jennifer. The fitness industry has existed for decades, but it's only been recently that gym owners have started asking themselves, you know, what are people actually doing in here? You know, how much time are they spending on this machine or that? Why are they using this one and not that one? And so they're starting to hire these consultants and to use wired equipment that tracks that data, and so they can analyze it and see what people are actually doing.
What are some of the things that they're finding?
Well, it's interesting. They're finding that what people look at the gym makes a lot of difference. For instance, some people actually prefer a view of the gym floor, other people working out while they're on a treadmill. They say that it gives them a feeling of being empowered. And some women also say they really don't like equipment where there's lots of people behind them. So like cardio equipment where there's, you know, backs onto a hallway or something like that. They just feel a sense of powerlessness, like people are coming and going and they can't see them. So those are things that are important to remember, especially because another finding is that the top piece of gym equipment for women is a treadmill. And so you want to think about where women want to be and what they look at when you position your treadmills.
I would think also that what you're looking at can motivate you, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, if you're seeing someone lift heavy weights, that can be kind of inspiring. Like, wow, you know, maybe I should do that next or work on my my muscles as well as my cardio.
What are they finding about some of these fancy machines? They seem awfully complicated.
They are. In fact, you know, every year when I go to trade shows and things like that, there's often new equipment or the latest and greatest. But what gym owners are finding based on this data is that people often don't want to try it because it seems complicated. Maybe it takes too long to figure out. Another thing they find is that if you do buy new equipment, if you're a gym owner, the last thing you should do is place it in a prominent place in the middle or in the front of the gym, which is counterintuitive, right? You just spent all this money. But what they find is that people who try this equipment, if they do try it, they don't want to try it while they're on display. You know, they might fumble with it or kind of look silly. They'd much rather try it if it's in the back of the gym or off to the side so they can kind of make mistakes and figure it out without witnesses.
But the fancy stuff is drawing in new members, isn't it?
You know, not necessarily. You know, it depends on whether there are things like personal trainers around who can actually show people how to use it. But these gym owners are finding that if there aren't those people there to instruct members on what to actually do with the stuff, they often just don't use it.
We're speaking with Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Rachel, your story talks about the fact that people actually want more room to stretch, and they also want more dumbbells. These are things that you could pretty much use in your basement, right?
I know, and this is another thing that was really counterintuitive to what gym owners think people want. I think they want to impress people with these long rows of the latest and greatest cardio equipment and you know, weight machines and so on. But, you know, a lot of people want to do basic workouts, which are very effective. They want to stretch out. They want more room to stretch out. They want to lift free weights, which are really gaining in popularity as we learn more and more of the benefits of weightlifting for men and women and people of all ages. And those are the things that gyms often have too little of, you know, too few free weights and too little space to stretch. This is a mistake that consultants see over and over again.
What about games and TVs and computers and all that fancy stuff that they're putting on some of the machines? Is that necessary?
Those can be very effective. If the interface is simple and easy to use, people do gravitate toward, you know, video on demand services and you know, TVs, things like that. They do even spend longer on machines if there is a video on demand service. Some data shows. Some people, of course, bring their own devices to watch or listen to, you know, podcasts or watch programs on. So that's definitely helpful to most people working out, which will be no surprise to anyone who's ever spent time on a treadmill.
All right. Thanks, Rachel. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 13 minutes now in front of the hour. The National League Championship Series is underway with the Cubs and Dodgers trying to punch a ticket to the World Series. The Cubs, as you know, were exceptionally good this year. 103 wins and the NL Central Division title. But exactly where does Chicago's dominating regular season rank in baseball history? Here's Neil Payne at 538.com. Neil, what'd you come up with?
So 103 wins, there have only been 47 teams to do that since 1901, 1901 being the first year that the American League was kind of considered a major league officially. And if you go back to the 162-game era, which started in 1962, it really happens only like once every 2.5 seasons. The last time that a team had done it before the Cubs this year was the 2009 Yankees. And so it's really only reserved for these, like, you know, notably dominant teams that they're kind of already in a group that includes some of the best teams of all time, if you do it that way. Now, I should also say that before 1962, teams played fewer than 162 games, so they had fewer opportunities to get to 103. So if you look at winning percentage, yeah, the 2016 Cubs are only the 74th best since 1901. So it kind of takes them down a little bit more. But then you have to also think about, you know, playing those extra games and just, you know, kind of getting to 103 wins is, you know, difficult in and of itself. So it's a big accomplishment, I think.
Wow. Does the 100-plus win mark mean that you're a lock for a World Series championship?
You know, no team is a lock for the World Series, especially now, I think, more than ever, since you have to go through these many different layers. I think if you won 100 games back in the, especially, you know, when the pennant was kind of decided during the regular season and only the top team in the standings from each league was ushered right into the World Series. And in that era, winning 100 games would probably get you the pennant most years, or winning 103 would almost certainly do it. And then you would only have to win 4 out of 7 against the best team from the other league to get the World Series. Now you have to actually go through, you know, many different, you know, 3 different rounds to win the World Series. And I think that makes it a lot more difficult. And there were teams that win 100-plus games don't win the World Series all that often compared to what we might, you know, kind of intuitively think when, like you said, it's such an eye-catching number and such an impressive number, you would think that they would win the World Series more often.
Wow. We're speaking with Neil Payne, senior sports writer and baseball editor at 538.com. He's got a piece called The Year of the Cubs. All right, so one thing you point out that maybe Chicago fans don't want to discuss that much, and that's their record in one-run games.
Yeah, so one of the things that we looked at just to kind of figure out, you know, they have this disparity between how many games we would think they would win based on how many runs they scored and allowed. And there's generally like a pretty strong relationship between, you know, that ratio of runs scored versus allowed and how many games you actually win. But if we look at the Cubs this year, if you just look at their run differential, they played like a 107-win team, which, by the way, is another level of just kind of impressive historically. There have not been that many teams that kind of had the run differential of a 107-win team.
That's Neil. Neil Payne, senior sports editor and baseball writer at 538.com. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. Good story from the police department in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Stories that aren't heard about or told often enough. A deputy named Brandon Hendricks was leaving headquarters earlier this month when he came across a woman outside who was homeless and barefoot. She initially thought she was going to be arrested, but he asked if he could help improve her current situation. She agreed. CBS News says Deputy Hendricks grabbed a fellow law enforcement officer, as is protocol whenever a male deputy has a female in his car, and drove the barefoot woman to a local Walmart. There, he let her pick out a pair of shoes that matched her dress. Then he paid for them. The other cop who accompanied him snapped a picture. It went viral. Now, many members of the Tulsa community are calling the sheriff's department to ask what happened to that homeless woman. All they know, however, is that she was originally from Arizona and just happened to be passing through when she was helped by Deputy Hendricks. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.